Everybody, the Antler Queens are back. I am Media Melanie along with...
I'm Kelly Geist, hello.
And I'm Emily.
And today we have a special guest joining us. We have Dr. Jessie Gold. Welcome to the Antler Queens podcast, Dr. Gold. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for joining us. We are very excited. This episode is going to touch upon the portrayal of trauma in Yellow Jackets. Dr. Gold actually wrote this article from InStyle magazine. It's titled, "I am a psychiatrist and Yellow Jackets is one of the best portrayals of trauma I've seen on TV." Dr. Gold, thank you for writing this article. As soon as we stumbled upon it, we knew that we wanted to discuss this as a topic. And again, we are thrilled that you're joining us. A little bit about your background. It looks like you're an assistant professor, director of wellness engagement and outreach in the Department of Psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about your background?
Sure, it's a mouthful just saying that part, so I appreciate it. But, you know, I'm a psychiatrist. I primarily see kind of college kids, faculty, staff, healthcare workers. That's my clinical population of choice. I also spend a lot of time doing wellness related things for the hospital and faculty, like running around helping during COVID because it's been particularly hard. And then in my free time, I write, and I started writing in med school and have written since, and really have always been interested in the intersection between pop culture and mental health, because that's where most people get their mental health information. And so I try to keep an eye on what's going on in the pop culture world related to mental health to be able to write pieces like this, because I do think they're a really good jumping off point to educate more and kind of fill in the gaps and correct what's wrong if there's something to be corrected. But I think that that's always been a really fun place to write from.
It's great. Absolutely. It's such an important bridge.
It really is.
And I think with the pop culture tie-ins, it makes it more relatable for the general population. So it is an excellent jumping off point for relatability, I think, for many types of people across all demographics and all life experiences. Yeah. Can you just give us a very brief summary of the article? Just kind of tell us, you know, a 1 minute or less summary of what you wrote about.
Sure. So I was watching Yellow Jackets. It came out right around the time of the finale in January 2022. I was noticing that the portrayals of trauma were great in that they expressed the whole span of symptoms, but also like 20 years of it. And I think that we don't see that very often. We don't see it happening in the acute sense and happening later. We also don't tend to see other symptoms that people can resonate with. So I just really wanted to write about what I was seeing and what I liked about it and what, you know, people could learn from watching it, I think, about themselves and about their friends or family members.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Have you received a response from the article? Have people reached out to you? We'd love to hear how it was received.
I think it was received well. I mean, I think for the most part, I tend to be pretty critical of media. So I think my friends were pretty surprised that I was nice. But I, you know, social media too, I think people were like, "You wrote a nice article about someone's mental health portrayal." And I was like, "I'm not mean," but I think that I tend to be a bit more critical because they tend to, that side of things tends to be worse for my patients, especially. So, you know, I did get good reception. I think people have resonated with the show for this reason, but nobody had really written about it. So I think that was also validating and normalizing of their experiences watching it and sort of reactions afterwards.
Absolutely. One thing you talked about is Yellow Jackets differentiating itself from trauma portrayal from other TV shows and how it's portrayed. Just tell us a couple of bullet points about how you think they achieved that.
Sure. So I think that most of the time when we see trauma, and I'm going to just trigger warning people because I can't control what comes out of my mouth for the rest of this time. So I just want people to know if you have a trauma, I take a break and realize that I'm giving you the trigger warning. But, you know, I think that when we talk about trauma, for the most part on shows, we see kind of a military related trauma and we see sexual related trauma. So lots of shows that kind of touch on both of those, not always in the best ways, but those are the ones we tend to see. We don't tend to see a lot of aftermath of other things. I think we've been slowly seeing that with some survivors of like gun violence or suicide talking about their experiences in shows and like using that to inform content. But I don't think we've seen something like this where it's like a big group that experiences a tragedy, at least for a long time, in this kind of way. So that's one way. I think when we typically see people's reactions to trauma, we see symptoms like flashbacks and nightmares, which are just sort of like one category of symptoms that you can see. We don't see a lot of the mood reactions. We don't see a lot of the life, like how it affects their life with friends and family, and especially in the long term. And I think that's different. I also think that, you know, there's a group of people and they're all going through the same trauma, but affected differently. And I don't think we necessarily see that either. So if you're seeing a person who experienced a sexual trauma, you're usually going to see the reaction of the person, maybe a friend or family member, but that's from being told, and maybe a partner, right, from interacting with the person. But you're not going to see this like whole group that technically experienced the same trauma, and how that relates to their life is different, and how that's affected their life in the long term is different. But that's so realistic, because we all have these things, like take COVID as an example. We've all gone through different experiences around COVID, but the primary stressor being COVID, right? And I think the way that we have grown and changed and coped is just really just different between people. And I don't think we talk about that enough. And one stressor might not even affect somebody, right? Like somebody could have been on there and been fine. And that's just the way that these things happen. And we need to talk about that more and realize that it is like a very diverse picture of people who are affected and how. And we also see men and women, like boys and girls, if you want to count their young versions. You know, we see it across a bigger perspective of people, sample-wise and population-wise too, which I think is nice.
Absolutely. Along with that, you mentioned a category of PTSD symptoms that's called alterations in arousal and activity. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think we like a lot of that comes from your inability maybe to remember the event. You might have negative feelings about yourself in relation to the event or something about the event. You might have some sort of distorted thoughts even about the event, and blaming yourself was really pretty common in a lot of trauma reactions. A lot of things like guilt and shame are actually related there, and we don't talk about that. This kind of situation is going to have a lot of that because of all of the things that happen, but you can assume some of that is a longer lasting kind of guilt and shame thing. And then, you know, we talk a lot about, I think people on things like TikTok talk a lot about things like dissociation, you know, not being connected to your body when you're experiencing something or you are triggered, and it's almost like you're watching yourself watch the thing. And I think that goes there too. And I think we've maybe seen that a little bit in media, but maybe not to the extent that we're seeing with someone like Thaisa, or, you know, even the way that Shauna kind of reacts in the moment when she feels like she's threatened could be very much a dissociation response to like, yeah, I just killed a rabbit and didn't mean to kill the rabbit, or like I killed a person and didn't mean to kill a person. Spoiler alert. But, you know, I think that those kind of things, like, it's like you don't have control as much about your reaction or your emotional reaction, physical reaction to things. And sometimes that can very much be because you're like in a triggered state where you're not as in control of yourself, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. Definitely. Absolutely.
You know, it's one thing that really struck me, that hit me really hard, that I thought was extremely powerful, was the moment when Shauna kills Adam. Mm-hmm. And she reverts back to young Shauna.
Yeah.
I mean, I just thought that was so brilliant. Like they basically physically manifested what was kind of going on in her psyche. Mm-hmm. Were you really satisfied with how they handled that overall?
I think so. It's hard to portray, right? I don't think they're trying to say that people who experience trauma experience violence and are violent, right? And I think that that's a hard thing to show when you're also portraying a group that becomes cannibalistic at some point and is obviously violent at some point. So there is like this weird, we don't want to make people think everybody's violent, but at the same time, like that might be their like innate reaction when they feel threatened because that's how they had to survive. And like, how do we portray this without saying something that is like all trauma survivors are X, right? Which happens a lot from TV shows, or all people with any kind of mental illness are X. But I think they did a really good job, even sort of like how she does knife work afterwards, for lack of a better way of saying that, you know, is very like motor memory. Like it's probably not even like she's really like actively realizing what she's doing in the moment. It's just like, I know how to do this. This is what I did to survive. I'm now on like autopilot about this thing that nobody would be on autopilot about, but you know, it protects you to take away the, oh, that's a person, or oh, that was someone I cared about, or I did that, right? It takes away the blame to yourself, but also just sort of like your ability. It makes it easier to do the things you need to do if you are removed in some capacity and sort of just doing the things and going through the motions, but not emotionally connected to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
it does. And, you know, we also see, similar to how Shauna fell back with her knife skills, you know, Nat falling back with her gun. You know, we see her in the adult timeline, you know, bringing the gun to go shoot Misty, something she was very comfortable with in the wilderness. And same with Ty and her sleepwalking. It seems like they all revert to this kind of comfort. I don't know if you'd call it a comfort, but we see that with all of them, you know, with the exception of Misty, although not really, because we see Misty still using poisons in the present day. And that was something she did in the wilderness. So it's interesting to see that they all kind of have this fallback, if you will.
Yeah, it's like they never really like matured past it, right? A lot of people say you kind of are stopped at the moment of your trauma. And like, you can see that when they get kind of sent back to it, and those skills help them survive, right? And so that's what comes out in them, like sleepwalking and kind of being disconnected from that in sleep, or being really good with the gun. But a lot of it is also like they have a lot of aggression and anger, and that's a PTSD symptom as well. But you know, I think they haven't talked about a lot of things, and so when they're triggered or when things happen where that's what their reaction is, like they've never really processed that in any capacity. So there's no way for them to be like, this is a bad thing to be doing, or this is a coping skill I shouldn't be reverting to. You know, a lot of people do that with substance use. And I would say eating would be another thing. Like, you don't necessarily have to have trauma for that, right? But it's like, I am overwhelmed. I feel an emotion I don't want to feel. I'm angry. I'm hurt. I'm whatever. I'm going to go to whatever comfort mechanism I have found that is quick and effective. And I don't want to feel this anymore. And so a lot of people, that is like turning to substances because you can kind of numb. It could be turning to food because you get like emotional comfort from food, or restricting food because you get emotional comfort from restriction and having that control. And in somebody that has sort of like coped with violence, or coped by protecting themselves with violence, however you want to say that, I think that that's sort of a very similar, like, this is a quick thing. I have this, I can go protect myself. And this is how I know how to protect myself. And maybe it's not a, if you're going to put a judgment on it, a great thing to be doing, but that's just what they know.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, one thing that really struck me in the article was when you talked about some of the teens were more prepared to jump into action, and those were the ones that had past trauma, and it was kind of seen as a skill set. We see it with Nat, Misty, and Travis, and, you know, the Jackies of the world may not adapt because they haven't had to deal with these kinds of stressors. So can you talk about how people with trauma and maybe some mental health struggles, you know, it's more of a superpower in certain situations, such as we've seen in Yellow Jackets?
For sure. I kind of hate the word resilience, but there's sort of like this resilience to your past experience that contributes to your ability to deal with things in the future. So this also came up a lot during COVID, right? Like, if you've had a big stressor in your life and been able to kind of cope and deal with it and develop skills to go on with your life and cope and deal with it, when a big stressor comes, you go, oh, I know how to do this. I've had something bad happen to me before. I've had something this hard happen to me before. These things worked when I did that. And maybe, again, like, those things are not going to last forever. When you're in the wilderness, you might get sick of those coping skills. They might not be as effective up front, but you certainly are more likely to be able to jump into action than to sort of freeze and say, like, I've never had this happen. This is horrible. I don't know what to do. Like, get me out of here. Right. And so all of them, at least we know from kind of flashbacks and this stuff in the past, that they've had trauma in their histories. And I'm sure other people have, maybe they haven't talked about it. There's definitely people we don't know a lot about their past enough to make that judgment call. But the people that do jump to it the quickest seem to be the people who are just like less fazed by it. I don't know how to say that in a way that doesn't sound like you shouldn't be fazed by crashing, complaining, and being in the wilderness, but it's right. Like, this is how you survive. I have to survive. And you have a strong survival instinct that you've already gone through so much that you know how to try to survive, at least. You know, maybe it's a different stressor, maybe it's a different trigger, maybe it's a different experience, but you learned a lot of things from what you had to go through before. And a lot of that is emotional suppression too, right? So when you've been through trauma and maybe never dealt with the trauma, but you still went through it, survived, did the things you needed to do, like got married, whatever, I don't know, like these things that happen in your life later that you maybe all of a sudden realize you had something bad happen in your past, you learn how to disconnect a lot, like to say, like, that's a thing that's happening and I don't have feelings about it. And that is also a survival skill, right? Yeah. Especially when you need to like figure out who's alive and what supplies you have, get to a location that feels safe and can actually save people. Like these things that you have to do, like if you're really emotional, you're not going to be as good at it because the emotions do get in the way. Like I'm a big, like, feel your feelings person for sure. But in these kind of situations, if you're crying, if you're angry so much that you can't do stuff, like you can't even think through the steps to find the like lake in the water, right? Like you just can't. And I mean, I think that you also can see like religion being a coping skill for other people. So that maybe wasn't trauma, but there's a belief in something higher. And that's what people turn to for things like substance use, right? Like it doesn't have to be God, it can be whatever, but knowing there's something greater can also be helpful to going through the motions to protect yourself, because ultimately somebody is protecting you in some way or supporting you at a higher level. And I think we see that in like people in the show as well, that are maybe not coping because of past traumatic experiences, but really coping because they have this other thing that's helping propel them forward. And it's interesting that then other people sort of are like, hey, what's that like? Like, can I also have a religious support in some capacity? Yeah. Because clearly I don't, like, I'm missing something that's helping you get through this. And like, I need that, even if I didn't believe that before. Yeah. I need to have something to believe in, some hope to believe in, some higher power to believe in, whatever that is. And so you see that happening too.
We see that with Lottie for sure. Like Lottie, like she just like clings to Laura Lee and Laura Lee's belief in God. And she like is so desperate for some kind of guidance out there that that's the way she turns.
And Jackie doesn't do any of that. Jackie's like, you know, complaining about the rotten food in the pantry.
Yep.
I mean, that like was it, that was such a small thing. It was such a small, subtle thing, like her getting upset and, you know, throwing a fit about the food and, you know, the conditions and everything. But I think it was actually really effective.
It was very Jackie.
Very Jackie.
It was just effective to say, look, here's somebody that just doesn't really have a lot of skills with coping with trauma and is not really jumping into that survival mode. She's
But it's interesting, right? Because she's a leader in all other sense, right? Yeah, like she has always been the leader. She's always been able to like get people to rally around things, to support people. Like she stood up for people in the team. Like she had this role, but that role isn't helpful in the wilderness if you have no experience like dealing with something like that. So it's like, it brings out a different skill set that like, even if you might have been the strongest leader and everybody turned to you before, if you can't support them in the moment of the thing, then you're not going to be a helpful leader in that situation. And I think it just brings up the fact that like, that's why we have so many different people in the world that do different things and come out in different ways as leaders. Because like, you know, when you're in these situations, some people rise to it in a different way, but you might have picked a different captain for your team at because you wanted a team who like somebody to support you like enthusiastically and cheer you on. And, you know, she's sort of like a cheerleader at times. And I think that helps, but there's a toxic positivity aspect to that when you're in the winter, like freezing and things are not good, right? And so you can't pretend things are good when they aren't. And I think that that comes out pretty clearly in this.
Absolutely. You know, another topic you talk about is asking for help. And, you know, that is one of the most important things that any trauma survivor can do. In this situation, you know, they don't ask for help. At one point, we hear Misty say, we couldn't get help, we couldn't betray the team. So for them, you know, their shared trauma and their group and whatever happened out there is more important than their own well-being and asking for help. So tell us a little bit more about the importance of asking for help, how it kind of plays in here, and how it plays into the adults and how they've survived.
For sure. I mean, I think they've survived in a lot of ways not talking about it, right? And that has become protective for them. And they have this bond with each other about not talking about it and sort of like what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas kind of thing, right? But at the time at which this starts to interfere your life 20 years later, right? Like a lot of these things you can't ignore forever. And that's the case with trauma in general. Like a lot of people experience things in their childhood that they lived through and they felt okay. And if you ask them about it, they'll sort of say, this happened in my childhood with like no emotion, no feeling, nothing about it. It's just a thing. And ultimately, there might be something in their future that triggers that, that makes that more evident, that shows that they have some sort of like propensity for substance use or something that might be coming from something that happened a really long time ago. And that's not their fault. That's just life. And I think we try really hard to push stuff under the rug and keep moving because that's a culture we're in. But it's also just kind of how people process a lot of times is like, I don't want to open that can because I can't put it, like close it again. And I have to actually deal with it if it's open, and that's scary. And so in a lot of ways, they're just not dealing with it because it's a lot. It would have been nice if like, I mean, I'm curious, like whenever we get to the point at which we see them come back, whether someone tries to have them go and they just don't trust anyone else, because it's very hard to trust other, like basically they've learned to only rely on each other because that was the only way, the only people supporting them. There's nobody else for a really long period of time. So to think that you could tell someone confidentially, like what happened, I think would be scary because what happened is not something that most people would understand. And I think, you know, I'm trained to not talk about those things, but you might be scared that you committed a crime and that I have to somehow divulge it because of like my ethical obligations or something, which isn't true. But like people might think that because, you know, you did legally something that would not be looked at correctly. Yeah. So they're also really protecting themselves from like what the aftermath of that could be by not having trust in people to keep that to themselves, even their friends and family. Right. And so, you know, processing trauma is complicated and you have to talk about it. It's like you have to go through it to feel better on the other side. And the going through it part is horrible. Like it just sucks. Like you feel worse before you feel better. It's really hard to convince people that it's fun or like something they should do or something they need because they know it's going to be really hard. And that activation energy is like just really tough. It's also like a timing thing for people. Like some people can't do it like actively in the moment. Some people have something else they really need to be dealing with at that time. Like the behaviors that are the result of the trauma might be more treatment interfering, as people use that word. But really, it's a thing that you have to be ready to do because they're going to talk to you about what happened over and over and over again until you don't have feelings because you're processed, not because you're removing them. And that's a hard thing for people in general. I mean, I'm kind of hoping somebody in this group like chooses to kind of get treatment and we see like a different 20-year course, because it would be interesting just to say like, what if somebody was like, I'm not okay. And like, I need help. Even if it was like, you know, when they're 30, instead of like in their, I guess they're kind of in their 40s, if I'm guessing, if they were like 30 instead, like what, and they finally were like, I can't do this anymore. Like I need help. Like what that looks like, because I think it's just helpful for people to see that like, different people follow different paths with this stuff. Like people ask for help at different times. It's totally okay whenever you ask for help. It's totally okay if like it doesn't seem to affect you until later in your life. Like it's complicated and trauma's like really has no timeline and is just super complicated like that for people. And as a result, like, you know, hiding it will work for a while until it doesn't. And I think that we see that in the behaviors they exhibit, but we don't really see any of them trying to fix that. So, I mean, you know, hopefully somebody will, or maybe they will in the future sense, because they're like getting more comfortable talking more with each other and supporting each other in that way. Like maybe someone in that sense will be like, we need to talk to somebody who's trained in this, but you know, I don't know. I'm hoping it's in somewhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because Jeff and Shauna were in relationship counseling, and now all of that stuff that she's been keeping secret from him is out in the open. So it'll be interesting if that comes into play, if she'll kind of decide to, you know, talk more openly about that, maybe, you know, maybe with a different therapist that's more equipped for that sort of thing. Or so it'll be interesting to see where that goes. Now that everything's on the table, at least with
Jeff. I think lying in therapy or selectively choosing what you tell is so common. I've done it. Oh, like, you know, you have to be in a certain part of your life to feel comfortable disclosing like everything to everyone. And even when you feel super comfortable with the fit in your therapist, like you might still wait a long time before you say certain things, and you're not like purposefully lying. Sometimes you're just like, I don't want them to know that right now. And like, maybe it'll come up later. Maybe it won't. But that's a very common reaction, like sort of, oh, well, our relationship's struggling. So like, let's talk about like cheating and our relationship as a partnership and how we can spice up our sex life. Let's completely ignore like all of the things in the background. Like I was dating the person that like was your best friend. There's a baby somewhere, like these things that like are clearly there, but like I don't know if that means they will feel ever comfortable talking about that, or they'll have to use like code words or like something. But there might be like some agreement of like maybe we can talk more about some of these things. I think their relationship's dysfunctional because like their relationship was grounded on dysfunction, you know.
Yeah, and so true.
Like, you know, I think there's no book club, right? So, but I think that like that therapist tried with what they know. You know, I think sometimes therapists can tell like there's things that aren't being told, but I doubt, like, I mean, they know if they looked up Shauna, they would know there's things not being told. I don't love to Google all my patients, but if they talked like, oh, remember that crash that you were in, I would probably not be like, tell me more about the crash. I'd be like the person's name and a crash and see what I could find out so that they didn't have to tell me everything. That's the joy of the internet. But, you know, I think they wouldn't know everything that's being left out of that. I don't think anybody does.
Right.
It might not even, right? Like there's no bait. So like he might not have ever known she was pregnant.
Right.
Yeah. Right. That's what we're dying to know. How much does he know? He read the journals, you know. I mean, he's got to know. But at the same time, if he did know, I mean, we've mentioned this before, you would think that he would have, you know, been out there trying to get some closure if the baby didn't die out there, which we don't know its fate anyway. But there's a lot of questions there. I do feel like there's some hope with Shauna opening up more. We see her and Ty having that, you know, really close heart to heart a couple times in the bedroom at Shauna's house and in the car with the blackmailer. So, you know, hopefully there is some hope that Shauna will be able to open up more to somebody. You know, it's a start, even if it's just with Ty. Maybe that will translate into sharing more in counseling. Who knows?
Ty and Shauna definitely have the healthiest relationship that we see too. Like, I know we've discussed this before on previous episodes. Their friendship is both in the adult and the teen timeline. They're just so bonded, and their relationship with each other, it's may not be healthy, but it's like the healthiest that we see for sure.
Yeah.
And they shared one of the most substantial traumas I think we saw. I mean, I know there were a lot of traumas, and, you know, we're going to ask you a little down the road which one you think is the most significant, but the shared trauma of the abortion scene, right? That's something we've talked about a lot. And I think that shared experience for Shauna and Ty particularly, you know, really translates into their bond in the present day. So what are your thoughts on the extent of the trauma from that abortion scene? That was really hard to watch.
I think some of it will be be dependent on like what we see in the future with the baby and all of that. Yeah. Because I think like anything, nothing about being pregnant is easy. I could get political on this, but I think that in a lot of ways, like, you know, there's just nothing easy about that experience in general, let alone as a teen, let alone in a plane crash. Uh-huh. So, it, you know, like that's not going to be something that she even probably processed the fact that she was pregnant in a way that was like helpful. Yeah. She didn't really make a choice. You know, she just sort of was like, I don't want to talk to Jackie about this. And like, I just needed to go away, right? Like this needs to not be a thing. And like, also the baby will probably die as we're trapped in the wilderness. Like there were like logic, there's logic to it and fear behind it. But I think none of that was then talked about later. And everything you don't talk about is a big trauma, I think. And, and even the smallest things can be like significant impacts on people's lives depending on how it impacted them individually. So whatever, you know, on a scale, it can't be easy. I mean, I do think you're right, it definitely bonded them in a different way, and they're more open with each other than, you know, they are with other people. Even if they don't really want to talk about a lot of the stuff, they still like clearly kept in touch better too. Yes. And like clearly like feel at least like, oh yeah, so this is happening to me again, like that's a thing. And you know, there's data on like peer support being significant for people at preventing things like PTSD, so like that isn't insignificant to have a friend you can tell the truth to. The reason why people then say like go to a like a counselor is like that in this situation the peer is also traumatized, but in the same sense like it's a lot to put on someone that's just like your friend. And so I think it's helpful to have both, because you can support each other, you could even talk about therapy with each other, but at the same sense like you're not like, here's all my stuff, hold it, here's all my stuff, hold it, and then you're just like, I'm gonna break, this is so much stuff, right? Which is what happens in a lot of like,
A friend is not a replacement for a therapist.
Yeah.
It can feel like they are sometimes, especially if you're like me and your friends are all therapists, right? But I think it's like, you know, even in that setting, like my friends don't need that, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Another point you talked about was people not grieving all at once equivalently, even if they all suffer the same loss. And in terms of the immediate impact of the trauma, we see that between the brothers, right? We see it between Javi and Travis. You know, Javi holds on to the chewing gum from his father, whereas, you know, Travis is not dealing with it in the same way. He's a little angrier, you know, his relationship with his dad translates into that. And on the opposite spectrum, we see people falling in love out there, right? With the kiss from a rose. We see, you know, Ty and Van falling in love. We see Travis and Nat getting together. So that disparity of the immediate trauma and how actually good things can come of it too, I think is interesting.
For sure. You know, I think I talked about this a bit in the article, but you know, we like to think that there's no good in bad things. Like you're, if you say something about the good stuff, that you're diminishing the bad or like ignoring the bad. But I'm like a yes and person or a dialectic person, meaning both are true, right? So you can have a horrible situation, but you could fall in love. Like you could have a horrible situation and you could make best friends. Like these things, like, and realizing those things and noticing those things do not diminish the fact that like they're in a horrible situation and they know it. But like having a dance and dancing to music sometimes is nice, right? Like it's not, it's a difference between something like toxic positivity, right? They're not saying like, everything's great, let's dance. It's like, I need to dance because everything's not great. And that's okay, right? And with the brothers, like one, it could be an age thing. It could just be, it could be the relationship with their father, which, you know, we don't know, but like, there's lots of reasons people grieve differently. Like you even notice that when you go to funerals, right? Like different family members are different things. There's like the clear kid that can give the eulogy because that kid can handle it. Then there's the kid that's crying. Then you have the kid that doesn't have normal emotional range and maybe is laughing. Like, right. There's just like everybody reacts to these things, especially in the moment, like very differently. And, you know, the way like the chewing gum thing is probably the way a lot of people are with like keeping mementos, going to graves. Like we do that a lot. Right. Yeah. But the like anger, like he had anger for a reason. And so it's hard when your relationships are complicated and the something like that happens because you don't really get to process the relationship before the thing. You have to process it afterwards. But I like how they do that with the different characters with these like kind of heavier, big mental health kind of related or mental health adjacent topics at times, because like, it's true. It's like, we're human, and the things that, the ways that we react, we could never really predict. And, you know, that's what makes it interesting, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's one thing that and it's funny because I know you said in the article that you're not a fan of horror. And I'm the opposite. I will watch pretty much any horror film you put in front of me. But one thing that always drives me nuts, and one of the main reasons that I started watching the show, is when the movie ends, typically what happens is the final girl or whoever gets away, and that's the end of it. You know, she went through this horrifying traumatic experience. So what's the rest of her life going to look like? That's what I want to know. And I feel like very few movies and TV shows have dealt with that. And we're talking about 25 years of trauma. Mm-hmm. I just think that's probably the number one thing that drew me to the show. I think that's just there has been such a gap for that. And I think they just really stepped into that and filled it beautifully.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the only things I can think of that do that will do like a quick recap in the future thing, like one year later, and then they show the thing and you might see what they're dealing with. Often they're quite good and they're fine. But they do that quick jump to the future, not like spending a lot of time in the future. And I think that that does draw you in and also makes you think more about like how complicated the human experience is. And we're drawn to stories. Like, that's why I do what I do, but that's why people write movies and TV too. But it's like, we want to see like what happens to people, and we're interested in why and the questions there. And, you know, I'm also interested in like, what are the parents doing? Like, yeah. And what has this been like for their families? Because that's another thing we don't see very often, which I'm kind of hoping that they have the creativity to think a little bit about, because we don't we'll see like the kid that survived something or like a shooting or whatever, but you don't see even like on TV in the news, like we don't tend to see a lot of stuff except for right in the aftermath of how it includes other people and mm-hmm. your kids like presumed dead on a crashed airplane, like where Misty broke the recording thing that like lets them know that they're okay or whatever, right? Sorry, my dog just decided to bark.
big.
She's the worst. I'm sorry. But at the same time, I think that it's like not shown enough, and I think it should be like, I'm really interested in like human dynamics in that way. Like, what are the parents doing? Do they just post posters? Like, you can't post posters, right? Like, it's not like the kid's missing, like missing on a mountain somewhere. Like how, and in the past when they didn't even have good technology. So like, what do you do? And like, are they in support group? Like, I don't know. I'm kind of curious, like, I hope they go into that, because it's another aspect that we don't see very much and would be interesting to kind of elaborate like what this has been like for people. We only see Jackie's parents, but they
sell their day every year. they've got some issues going on there. So
yeah.
Oh boy.
A little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in episode 7, Natalie says to Shauna and Thaisa, "You guys are just as fucked up as I am. You're just better at lying to yourselves. You're not healthy. You're not stable. You're living on the brink, just like me." And, you know, I think that's very telling. Again, you know, they each had the shared trauma, and they're all, you know, overcoming it very differently. And something interesting is, you know, Shauna and Ty have their support system, whereas Nat doesn't. And, you know, I know Kelly wanted to touch more on Shauna and Ty's family as well. And, you know, how that may be good and bad for them in terms of how they've resolved their trauma.
Yeah. I'm very interested in, just as somebody who's dealt with a lot of trauma myself involving family members. You know, it's interesting to me. We see Thaisa and Shauna in these relationships. One looks pretty distant, but in the end, you know, looks like they're in a pretty good place. Meanwhile, with Thaisa's family, I mean, they just seem like such a perfect such a supportive, perfect family. And then towards the end, Taissa and Simone aren't even living together. And, you know, it just, it makes me curious that things kind of started changing in their relationships once this whole thing came back into play. Mm-hmm. You know, and plus there was the 25th reunion, which that alone was probably triggering for them.
Yeah.
Even without getting a kiss from a rose.
That would be right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that would just like bring them back immediately. Yes.
And yeah. they probably have every year, but they always probably like do some sort of memorial at that school. And I bet because that's what the class was defined by, all of the pictures were about, you know, like it's just like the case, the trophy case, that thing. Like that's probably always a thing. Like they're not just like a person, they're a person in their class that was there. And so that can't be normal.
It's their trauma bond, class of 96 trauma bond.
For sure. Yeah. A trauma party with some kiss from the rose. But you know, I think that quote from Nat is telling in that like we have an assumption of not what not doing well looks like. It's the person who's alone and using substances and unable to commit and violent and angry and hitting the vending machine, like these things that you see. I see a lot of people who are not doing well that you wouldn't know are not doing well. Like they have full-time jobs. Well. They work in like a very elite situation in academics or in medicine, but yet they've had really hard lives and they experience hard things. It just doesn't come out in the way that Nat expresses it, and it doesn't affect their job or relationship until it does, right? And so in a lot of ways they've been able to say like, this is what I have to keep going, like keep going, which means like I find a partner, I keep going in my career, I become addicted to achievement or something instead. So like you can see these sort of like power toxicity that Taissa has, which I'm sure is like kind of what she's kind of grappled on, like okay, well like I can keep going, and if I always have something to keep going towards, like then I'm okay. And Shauna is sort of like in that with love and her daughter and this, like, if I take care of people or do what I'm supposed to do, like everything's okay or whatever. And so I think it just manifests in different ways. And then secrets do too, right? So with family. So like, I think probably because Taissa's relationship was so close to her wife, like the secrets were more of a big deal. Like, I think like they were more toxic to their relationship because she thought, why won't you tell me? Like, I can deal with this. Like, I'm a good support for you. I've always been a good support for you. Like, tell me what's going on. And she just doesn't want to. And she prioritizes like her power and her future and stuff. Right. And I think like those things, like in a good relationship are hard. In a bad relationship, maybe you get away with like some lies and stuff. And then you're like, our relationship's really horrible. We should probably fix this. Right. And like you do or you don't, but there's just less like riding on that. And I think also there's the kid involved is younger. And the kid involved is younger and affected. Clearly. Yeah. Like very it's some affected. Sort of like we're like, whatever that kid's seen has really messed that kid up. And so I think that's another thing. Like you don't really see that in Shauna's kid. She does like kid stuff, but she's not like, she doesn't seem affected by her mom's stuff, minus the like kind of, I'm going to wear like Yellow Jackets uniform to this party because like this, that's what I do. Like she probably thinks it's an interesting part of her history or something, right? Whereas like the little, like he's young and he's like very much affected by seeing his mom do stuff that she doesn't even know she's doing. And that's scary. And it makes him into like a more creepy, violent kid than he might otherwise be. And like somebody's got to protect the kid in that situation. And so I think that's also part of it, which is like, I love you, but I have to put this kid first because whatever is going on with you is not good for the kid. And I could love you, but like, we can't do this right now because I have to prioritize the kid. And I don't know that.
Sammy, his name is Sammy. Yes. And like the pictures, I mean, what's your take on some of that drawing stuff? You know, I mean, where is he getting that from? I mean, we don't know specifically, but what are your thoughts on Sammy and some of these images we see from him?
Yeah, I mean, there's like a weird spiritual kind of aspect of, or like, you know, wolf symbolism thing with Taissa. Yes. And I don't know how that has like translated to her kid, but clearly some way, like it comes up in conversation or in a way that like she's telling a story to him and that's what he registers. I don't know. Some of that could be unconscious. Some trauma could be genetic, like and passed down, because you can see that some households that have trauma, right? It might not be that they're actually hurting the kid or something like that, but they can feel it and sense that something's off. But also if you like woke up in the middle of the night and your mom was looking at you from a tree, like, I don't know what you would get from that. Like you would like, it's almost like you want to like dissociate that with the person, you know? And so you create these like characters to protect yourself, and kids make up stories for, what happened, right? And like how things are happening. And if you look at like kids' drawings are often like expressions of what's going on in their mental health and like how they've processed it. And yeah, they have very concrete, pretty naive ways of dealing with stuff. And a lot of things they believe are like their fault. And you know, that because they can't process that anybody else is like in the in the equation. And so I think like there's probably a lot that is just how he's coped with what he's seen and removing what he's seen from the person that he knows and loves. And like, that's been too hard for a young boy.
He has to have seen quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, the very fact that he refers to when he sees, we have two Melanies suddenly. Yeah.
Oh boy. I'm like,
hey.
I thought you were I thought you were testing my own perception. I was like, this is the Rorschach test and I failed.
Sorry about that. Minor tech difficulty. Okay.
We got two Melanies. My lighting somehow went back to normal somewhat. I don't know what's happening today. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, he's obviously been seeing her in the tree, but he's not referring to her as he's seeing his mom in the tree, seeing the lady in the tree. Or, you know, or the bad one also, as he referred to her as. So that definitely plays to your point. You know, he's trying to make a clear separation between, you know, this is not my mother. If he didn't make that separation, I mean, he might not even be able to be around his mother without being terrified.
It's crazy that he's able to make that separation at the age that he's at too, because he's, like you said, he's so young. So for him to be able to distinguish, like, that's not my mom in those moments, like, that's big for a little kid.
It could just not even be conscious, right? Like, it could be like he actually has decided it's a different person. Yeah. And like, that's how his like young brain has protected him to say like, well, like, it's not like he's consciously like, when she does that, it's not my mom. But it's like, that's this concept of a thing that's outside of her. And so I've made it its own like entity, right? Like the bad one or whatever. And so it's different even than like we would process that with like a mature sense to be like, oh, my mom is struggling with X. When mom struggles, she does Y. That's not mom, that's the disease. I don't think he's doing that. I think he's doing like, keeps happening and I'm going to just put that over there. And that's this whole concept that I'm defining that's not mom.
Yeah.
The brain is so incredible to be able to come up with these coping mechanisms or whatever. And like you said, Emily, it's such a young age too. And it'll be interesting to see how Sammy's story unfolds, you know, and how their relationships go. And you know, where are the relationships going to go, right? Shauna and Jeff, Ty and Simone,
will Thaisa even be able to have a relationship with her son after Simone discovers that altar in the basement?
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Like, will she allow Thaisa to be around her kid? Because what is Thaisa going to say? I don't know how that got there.
She doesn't really, but I think, you know, I think it's interesting. It depends on how disease conscious someone is, right? So this happens a lot with substance use, right? You have to give boundaries, but if the person recovers, you can usually let them back in their life. But like, you have to show certain things, like you need to go, like she would need to go to treatment. There's absolutely no way on earth that you could find that, attribute it to trauma and be like, cool, I'll see you at dinner, right? You would have to, like, you would say like, here, like, I love you. our kid loves you. We want you in our life. The way to have you in our life is XYZ. You have to show that you did XYZ and then you can come back in our life, like 100%. So like, that's what you would do with someone who had like really stolen money from you or some like crashed your car while your kid was in it when you have substance use, like really, like you, it's a lot of really pretty unforgivable stuff, but at the same sense, like, it's a disease. And so if you can conceptualize it like that, it is also separate from her in a lot of ways, but you have to learn how much you can give and deal with that. But she would, I could not picture, like, if that was my patient, like her wife was my patient, I couldn't picture that just being fine without some step to show that change was happening, which is, it has to be treatment. Like, that's like inpatient treatment, but that's treatment. Like, you can't just like, have that going off. You can't, it's scary, like it you don't know what violence means either, right? Like, I think that you can know the person, and the person when they're most affected by whatever's going on in their mental health could do things that are so out of character, like kill a dog. Could they then hurt your kid? You would really worry that would be true. It'd be really hard to convince yourself it wasn't unless you knew that you'd seen a significant change, significant growth, and you were a part of that and made sure it happened. And time's going to be big there, I think.
And she's hurting herself too. We see the bite on her hand, which we assume is her biting herself, maybe not a dog bite. And I mean, do you see that as something that she did to wake herself up from the state or something? I mean, which came first, right? Was she in the dissociative state when she bit herself? Did that wake her up? What's the significance of the bite?
Good question. There's also, again, this sort of like wolf, dog, animal thing with her, like that I don't completely understand, and hopefully we will later. But like, self-harm's complicated too. Right. So it could be in an attempt to get yourself out of that state. It could also be in an attempt to feel something because you're not feeling anything else. Right. So like, you're completely dissociated. You might not be aware of what's going on, but you're also like just completely emotionally like disconnected from the situation. People do things like punch things or hurt themselves in those situations, not because they like want to end their life or really hurt themselves, because they want to feel something physically on their body to know that they're still there. And like, that could be that too. I haven't seen biting like that often, but I think we see it in kids. Like, it's a sort of naive reaction to immature reaction to stuff. Like, it could happen because she's, again, pretty stalled. They're all pretty stalled in their growth and their development emotionally. So it's possible that that's what it is.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, along with the wolves that she kind of hallucinates, we see the man with no eyes throughout. We see that first at a very young age before any of this trauma that Ty experiences. So, you know, what do you think about that particular hallucination, the man with no eyes, as and how it may relate to the wolf in the present day?
There's some spiritual thing with that too, like with the, was it grandma? Like,
yes.
Yeah. And she started it as a thing. I don't know if like when she was scared, if it came up a lot in her childhood. And so then when she was scared again, like, cause she was in the wilderness, if that became something that like represents like fear and the unknown and like loss of control and somebody coming for you, whatever, right? Like this sort of presence that's really scary. But I could imagine that if you started like seeing that as a kid and associating that feeling with that vision, that like as you got older and you sort of revert to that same feeling, you could still have those visions. They might be scarier if you're an adult and are like, I thought I got rid of this. But you know, I could see that. I think it wouldn't, you know, hallucinations are complicated. We don't tend to see things that often. They usually tend to be like brain related. If we see things, we tend to like hear things more often, or like kind of entirely flashback, like a whole kind of emotional thing, like not just like the one thing that happens to be there. But it's symbolic in some capacity of something she's dealing with subconsciously, I think.
And the eating of the dirt, do you see that as more of like a chemical response to pica and a nutritional deficiency? Or do you, I mean, I know we're speculating here, of course, or, you know, is she in the dissociative state? It seems that she is because she doesn't remember Lottie seeing her when it happens. But what do you make of the dirt eating?
I'm not sure. That's a huge speculation. Huge. Like, I think it could be both. Like there could be some odd like iron, you know, need to replace what's going on in your life and not eating anything in the wilderness. And also like, again, she sort of becomes like a dog, like dogs do things like that. And
that's so like true.
I don't know what that is, but there is some sort of like wolf, like protection of becoming a wolf or dog, like person, like going in the trees and whatever. Right. And like, maybe it's like, when I dissociate, I'm a wolf, and wolves like eat the dirt. And so I do too. Like, and my behaviors don't match like being completely human, because in those moments I'm not.
Well, you know, it was interesting when the scene where she saw the wolf outside in the present day, I had brought this up on the episode where we covered this episode, but I was wondering if the dog was even barking or if she was just imagining it. But the dog wasn't looking out the window and barking at the wolf. The dog was barking at Thaisa.
Yeah.
Which was really interesting to me. That kind of threw me off. So that would kind of, I think, go hand in hand a little bit with what you're saying about,
you know, the dog tie-in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. These dual personalities, you know, of her, like kind of the wolf being kind of like this alternate persona. You know, it's almost like, I mean, Thaisa's obviously somebody who's a fantastic leader. She's a natural born leader. And this could be, you know, she was seeing the wolf at the dinner party. And mm-hmm. And another thing that I've noticed about the wolves is they all seem to be in a very, their posture seems to be very submissive when she sees them. And it makes me think, you know, yeah, there's just this man with no eyes going on too, that she keeps seeing, but you know, she seems to have this need to control everything around her. And that would be really kind of a smart way to differentiate from her from the others. You know, she kind of has this wolf-like persona that just, you know, Natalie's drinking again. They start getting the postcards. Natalie's drinking again. And Shauna's having an affair. And, you know, Thais has got her own issues at home, but she's like, she's starting to see this wolf. And it's almost like this opportunity for her to kind of step into this other persona and start taking control and, you know, over what she can, over what she's able to. And even if it's just more of a, an optics thing in her mind, like she just wants to feel like she's in control, even if she's not.
And, are there leaders of wolf packs? Like, is somebody mm-hmm. the leader in the wolf pack? Like, yep. You could also say like a sports team is sort of like, you know, so yeah. Like Abby Wambach's book is called like Wolf Pack. So it's got something to do with soccer too. But I think you could say like, maybe it's like a call to action or leadership in like sort of a very like animalistic way, because that's again like what you have to like, they eat people at some point, so there's like a very like animalistic thing that comes out of them, and that was triggered by her eating like meat, right, too, like she chose she stopped eating meat because it like made her feel like she was like back there. Like, I don't know that I could eat meat either if the last meat that I had was that.
Never.
You know, and so I think that it could be something like that, like a animalistic like nature that comes out in these situations that she doesn't have control of in the way that she would like to. And she's so buttoned up and controlled otherwise that it's like scary.
You know, and meanwhile, you've got all of this rabbit symbolism around Shauna, and Shauna's kind of the one who's somewhat shrunk into herself and has just kind of tried to hide and protect herself and become numb to everything and just keep her voice down and try to disappear. So it's definitely an interesting comparison. You know, she's kind of like the frightened rabbit in a little way.
Mm-hmm. But she really like also it. Like, but when she wants to, she takes control in the same way, right? Like she like lets go of the thing telling her to like be meek and the housewife and the mom, mm-hmm. and instead
jumps off a bridge.
Yeah, or jumps off the bridge or like kill a person, right? Like there's something in there that she's also trying to like push down that she doesn't like the rabbit was encroaching on her territory and so was the guy, right? Like they're going against the boundaries that she's put up to protect herself. And when they do, she can't fight it in a way that's like typical. She has to fight it with violence or whatever comes up, which is more of this sort of like primal thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting how she can flip on a dime. You know, she has this persona where she seems so kind of meek and mild, and then, but she has absolutely no trouble whatsoever telling Jessica right up in her face to go fuck herself or to, you know, the way that she, I mean, the way she manipulated her daughter into going along with,
I love with that not scene.
Telling Jeff everything was just so brilliant. She just went into that so easily. It's, yeah, she's definitely got kind of a, you know, two sides to her personality for sure.
You're not best friends with like a queen bee and not picking that stuff up. Like, and also if you're friends like a queen bee, you've also learned how to be a mean girl because you're probably actually the drone, right? Like Jackie's not going to yell at someone. She's going to say like, Shauna, can you believe what this person did to me? And Shauna's going to be like, hey, don't screw with Jackie, because that's like her role, right? So I think like if you think of sort of like mean girl hierarchy too, like the role of like the friend in the queen bee relationship is like passive to the person and really like overly flattering to the person, but also like super the one that's like defensive elsewhere and the one that's like getting her dates, right? Like it wasn't, she has to just say that's her job. It's like help her social life. Like, and that, and I think you can learn a lot from that. But if you combine that with like actual skills in a wilderness, maybe that's like why she's so successful, because she's sort of like a combination of what she learned from being friends with somebody in a high school kind of wilderness and actually having survival skills that makes her more of like a, makes her more of a leader than Jackie for sure.
Yeah.
And Jackie tells her.
Yeah.
Jackie says like you turn into a badass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, she immediately fell in. The next person she immediately fell in closely with was Thaisa, who is, you know, also kind of, she's kind of another leader. She's a really strong leader.
Yep. Shauna makes a good second in command, I suppose.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. But,
you know, it's interesting because I think Thaisa recognized Shauna's individuality a little bit more than Jackie did.
For sure.
Yeah, it's I don't feel like she's ever treated Shauna as a minion or anything like that. Whereas Jackie kind of, you know, in a way, kind of treated her as a henchman sort of. I mean, she showed that she obviously had a lot of love for Shauna. But you know,
she was in charge though.
Yeah. Mean girl love is complicated. Like, I don't know. I had a middle school experience like that. I mean, I think it's just, it's very real, but I think like often they do care. Like if you took away those people, those were their friends. Like it really does matter to them, but they just don't express love in the same way or they're not, you know, grateful in the same way. So you don't know. And then like, you know, stealing her boyfriend is going to be like the worst thing you could possibly do, you know? And so it makes sense. Like it's, again, it's stupid. It's so interesting to have the like stupid teen drama sort of like juxtaposed to the fact that they're in like a wilderness and they're like trying to survive, because like, if we ever have conversations with teenagers, like they think that's like the worst thing, you know, it's like this, like my life is over. Like I will never find someone like that again, or like a friend like that, or a boy like that, or whatever. It's like this, it's like the worst thing that's ever happened. And it's very characteristic of that like time frame of people. I see like 18, 19 year olds and they're still doing that. And so I think it's like very selfish, like the world that is, even though like the world around you could be a hot mess. It's like, well, I didn't get to do whatever. Like that's the problem with COVID. It's not COVID. It's that I didn't get to go to like the trip I was planning.
And or the like, prom or whatever.
And you're like, that sounds so selfish, but in your mind, like that was huge for you. And it's been something you were looking forward to. And like you can understand it in a lot of ways, but in the scheme of things, it's like ridiculous, but you're still like, you have a right to your feelings about it, and your feelings yeah. about it are valid because it was that big for you. But the fact that that's that big for you is just such a like viewpoint of that time and that age group that is interesting too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, before we were kind of talking about which yellow jacket we each thought was the most affected. And Emily, I know you mentioned that, you know, in your opinion, Ty suffering the most from PTSD. Talk a little bit about that. And then we'll ask Dr. Gold, who she thinks has been the most affected by the trauma in the adult timeline.
Yeah, I just wanted to know which adult yellow jacket that you thought suffered the most severe form of PTSD, I guess. I personally assume Ty, because like we've said already, it's almost like she created this like second persona, this second personality where she like completely detaches and has no memory of anything that she does. And that is such an extreme coping mechanism that I just, in my personal opinion, I feel like it's more severe than the other two. And also you highlight Natalie, Ty, and Shauna, but you don't talk about Misty. So I was wondering if you think Misty suffers from PTSD or not.
Good question. I am a big, like, no one's trauma is more important than anybody else's person. And that, like, we don't know how much this is affecting all of their lives. So a caveat on that, because I do think, like, if I met Shauna in a therapy session, I might feel very differently, or like she's holding it together in a way that we don't really understand. And like killing someone is obviously like not yeah. a thing, right? So I think like in like a symptomatic sort of like actively symptomatic, you can see it on screen. Like you're right about Thaisa, because like dissociation is really scary for people. And that often is really scary for people. And when like it affects their life in a way where they're like, well, killing a dog, but on top of it, like ending up in a tree, like things like that, like she's in a very dangerous place with her trauma. Whereas like, you know, Nat, like she's always been kind of destructive and she just got out of rehab. Like she's in a, you know, people who just get out of rehab first 30 days are at most risk for relapse and things like that. And so she's also obviously relapsed, and you can tend to sometimes use like more drugs at that point then. And that could be dangerous to like actually not survive that. So like, she's obviously in a dangerous state, but you would send Nat to like a substance use and trauma center, and you would send Thaisa to trauma like stat. And like, you wouldn't want her, like she's not going to get benefit from being in like an inpatient hospital. She needs to go to like a trauma recovery program, which there are that are usually like about the same as substance use, like 28 days, 30 days or so. And then stepping down from that, so you can like actually integrate what's going on with yourselves, right? Like her selves are like so not connected that she's at more risk because she has no control like over it. Whereas like Shauna is like over controlled until she's not, which is its own thing. And like Nat is like, just doesn't want to be in control. And so like, that's not a choice, but it's just what she does to cope. And so I think they're all at risk to themselves and others in different ways, but like actively right at this moment, at the end of the series, like who would I send to treatment tomorrow? Like it would be Thaisa. Yeah. I don't mention Misty because it's complicated. I think there's like other stuff going on with her that might not even be on like a traditional diagnostic spectrum. Like that's a little bit more like the stuff that ends you up in jail instead of a psychiatric hospital.
Could she be a serial killer? Do you think she has it in her to be a serial killer? Is she displaying any of those tendencies?
I mean, it's hard because like killing animals and like whatever, like they were in a wilderness. So I don't know how to exactly say like a triad of serial killerness in her, but like she, it doesn't, like if you were traumatized, you wouldn't break the recorder.
Yeah.
So there's that alone, or whatever that is, the thing that was actually like, is like a beacon, right? Yeah. Like it's the way that they would the find box. Them. Yeah. Like you wouldn't, that is not a trauma response. That's a some other thing. Like, I am successful in this space and I'm going to keep it going. There's some degree of narcissism to that. The way she treats the coach is also bizarre. Like, she's basically keeping him prisoner until, you know, like, and he has to like pretend so she can keep helping him. Like, it's not like she has tendencies that like she just wants to be liked, but in her like desire to be liked, it's scary. And yeah, she could be. I think she genuinely cares about like the people that were on the team, and that's why she was the manager, and that's why she tried to be like their friends and stuff, and they didn't notice her at all. But like the way she protected like Nat from using, and like I think she cares, but her care is not typical. And I'd like to know if that's because she doesn't know how, because no one modeled it for her, because we don't know enough about her background. But like, she just doesn't know what caring for people looks like. Like, it's at this like unhealthy degree. It's like only in dangerous situations. It's like, what's the limit I could push this to that someone will still care about me? Like kidnapping that person was also a sign of care, right? Like, she was like, I need to protect us. Like, I care about these people. This person's going to hurt us. So like, I'm going to steal her and make her my prisoner. Right. And like, that's not like, again, that's not a trauma response. That's like something else. And so I didn't put her in the article because I also am not an expert on like more like on the criminal spectrum of brains, but you know, she wouldn't probably be someone that could get off of her crimes for mental illness because she knows what she's doing. Right. So like, when it's a very tight line on that stuff, because for the most part, we don't like, people don't want to just like put people in psych hospitals for their whole life. Like, you know, you have to have had like a diagnosis before, a clear diagnosis after, like no understanding of right or wrong because of your mental illness. Like, you don't even understand like judge, jury, all that. She'd have no trouble with that. She knows what she's doing. Yeah, and so I don't think it's like trauma. I think it's like her.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. That's so bad to say. Well, it is. And she's actually a care assistant, which is the most ironic of all. You know, we've just talked a lot about the care and, you know, caring, and she's supposed to be caring for other people in her profession. And she's doing the opposite. She's withholding medicine. She's, you know, disconnecting the machine to scare the trick or treaters, which is traumatic on both ends. So you know, I mean, you know, what's up with that? And how did she pursue that career? You know, is it just this need to be cared for that was never met, and so she pursued that? How do you see her profession tying into her potential mental health or criminal aspects?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the only thing we know about her is she looked neglected, right? Like playing with like a rat or something, right? Like she, whatever we saw was not like she was supported in her familial relationships are what we see. And then she joined a team to find a family. And probably they didn't treat her like that until there was a crisis, which taught her, oh, look how I can make a family. This is how you make a family, like this stuff. And so you create like, you know, she's probably still constantly sort of looking for that. Like, how do I find people who like love me, or I can love them, and whatever. And then like, you know, old people tend to not have a lot of people in those places don't have their own support system. So there's probably like a lot of dependency on her for things, not just because they can't physically or mentally do it, but because they don't have anybody else. And so she gets to play that role of like savior, like, and like endorse that kind of complex. But she also, like, if the person's feeling better, like she doesn't have the control anymore, so like she's gonna screw around with them, and she's gonna like think it's funny and not see a problem in pulling someone's like you know, cord or whatever, because she's like, oh, it's a funny joke, like why is this not a funny joke? But like, she just doesn't have like the same emotional range or connection to people. And like, she thinks she cares, like I think she thinks that she's caring for them, but I think like nobody taught her the right way to do that, or taught her that that is wrong. Like, I don't think anybody ever taught her right from wrong, but for sure didn't teach her like what care looks like. And so like, she's probably in that job because she's constantly seeking it. And there's a degree of like feedback that you get in that role that is satisfying that, even if sometimes she like kind of flips and wants it back, you know?
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, I know that, you know, armchair diagnosing can be dangerous and
they're fake characters though. So I have more of an ability to do it. Yes.
I mean, do you see the potential for maybe like some Munchausen by proxy in her?
Oh, because like something's wrong with her mom or something, like her parents.
Something that we had talked about before is we noticed that, you know, we haven't seen her parents, as you had mentioned. You thought that she might be neglected, which I think is probably a good assumption. That pool that she was sitting outside of was really nice. So I'm guessing her family probably has some money and they could be in the medical profession. I'm wondering if perhaps Misty might have some tendencies toward, you know, Munchausen by proxy, and if maybe she inherited that somehow from like one of her parents or, you know, yeah, it just,
I would think that there's more like this, the only way to get attention is to be hurt or emotional or which would maybe be in the borderline personality disorder spectrum, which is to say like, not that most people with borderline are like this at all. Let me just say that because they get a ton of stigma and I don't want to add to that.
Yeah.
But the concept that I mean that's related to borderline is they're often in cases of like trauma or abuse or something where the only way they know to like get someone to notice them or get someone to give them love is like a very severe degree of emotionality or hurt or, you know, someone will listen to me if I'm crying, like someone will listen to me if I'm yelling. That's the only way that can happen. So that can happen in a chaotic household, like the parents fight all the time and or hurt each other or something, or a neglectful household. So I think it could go either way. But I would say like my gut would be it's more that like that she's learned that I can love someone if they're hurt. Or I can love someone if they're, you know, but I don't know. Like that's sort of where my mind would go. But again, like, I think I need more information.
More context on her background. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, in terms of universal trauma in season one, is there one event that you can pinpoint as being the most generally traumatic for the group? I know there's a lot. And of course, the plane crash itself is very traumatic inherently. But what are some other specific events in season one that you see as the most traumatic, perhaps that help shape the adult Yellow Jackets?
So I think it starts with that breaking of that bone.
Like leg bone, right in the pilot.
Because also, like, that girl got to miss the plane.
Yeah.
Right.
So, like, how bad does she, like, that's weird. That's a thing. Like, she probably has survivor's guilt. They probably hate her. Like, there's a thing, right? I think that is the first kind of, like, entry into, like, what we're seeing as, like, you know, young adult trauma, right? Like, I don't know about... There's past stuff, right? And so that's there. And past stuff, the other stuff builds on it. And so, sorry, she's like out of control today. The other stuff builds on it. And so, like, that would be the start for me. There's no way that, I mean, the plane crash is the thing.
Right.
And like, then you throw on like trying to find food, like trying to understand how to have like your period in the wilderness, like these things that like shouldn't be problems are now problems, right? Like finding food, like finding water, like cleaning yourself, like taking care of yourself in a way that you feel is like human.
The hallucinating too, the mushrooms, right? For some people that didn't even know they were hallucinating. I mean, that's kind of crazy too.
Yeah. The weather, the plane crash of, Laura Lee.
Yeah, the explosion.
Like that's a thing. Oof. Like when we try to get away, we die. Right. Yeah. That's what that told you.
With
like,
too.
The wolves.
So like these things sort of like compound, obviously, like with the plane crash being sort of like the mushroom umbrella that like caused them all except for the broken bone. And I think they would have not cared about the broken bone if there wasn't a plane crash. It would have been like, that was a disgusting thing that I just saw. And like, I saw your bones, right? Like they, it would have been like, gross. Like, can you believe what we saw at school today? And then that would have been it, right?
Right.
Like, it wouldn't be like a thing. And so I think that all of them like compound underneath the big umbrella, and all of them wouldn't have happened if it weren't for the big umbrella. But like, I think that that is the sort of crux of it all, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things that like we don't even think about regularly. Like just, I mean, how Coach Martinez looked laying in that tree, you know? Oof. I mean, that alone had to, would be, just that one incident would be horribly traumatizing for them all.
His body falling down. Yeah, oh my gosh. Alone,
like, yeah. Or I mean, or, you know, the one remaining adult that's there with them, who can provide some sense of security, has lost his leg.
And yeah, watching, you know, his leg got get chopped off. I mean, yeah, that's another traumatic moment. There's a lot of little traumas built into under this umbrella of the larger overarching trauma.
It's sort of sure. interesting, right? Because we usually use a terminology like big T, little T, and the little T's are like divorce, moving, like whatever. But in the context of like a plane crash where like lots of people died, like the littler T's are like, I saw a dead body, like I couldn't eat, there were wolves. Like any one of those like on their own would be like a big T from like definition in like how we're thinking of like PTSD being caused by something like that. The little T's are all these things that are really significant in our lives that like compound and still can make our lives hard and affect our emotional well-being, right? But like they're all big in the normal scale of things, but like in this scale of like whatever plane crash, it's they're all just more and more and more things.
Right. Now, Jackie's death, big T or little T?
Big T.
Big T.
Especially for Shauna.
Yep.
But, you know, and like, speaking
she
of.
She died outside. They kicked her out. Like, yeah, you know, when it, on the grand scheme of things, like it was, it's exactly what you would have done in a normal situation with that. Yep. You would have kicked her out of your house and said, like, leave. But yep, she died. And so I think like it emphasizes how abnormal the situation is to them, but that was also like their leader in other circumstances, Shauna's best friend. And like, she was acting badly, but like, that's the kind of stuff where like, if you were in school, you would have been mad at them for a couple of days and then you'd got over it. Like it would have been, or you wouldn't be friends and you'd make a new friend group, whatever. It was not going to be a thing. And so the fact that like, the thing led to like her death is like, there's no way that doesn't traumatize you.
Right. And then,
and also Travis.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, he went through kind of a hellish experience that nobody's acknowledging, including himself. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see see the fallout from all of this. I mean, they've got Jackie's death. I can't imagine being part of that group and feeling safe around these people. I mean, except for maybe, you know, Natalie. the showrunners have said that things are going to start falling apart pretty quickly when we come back. But yeah, I mean, gosh, they just lost a member of their team because of this fallout. And
like, do they eat her?
Yeah, that's, I know.
That's the question, right? So, we just did a Jackie's death episode. We want to know
think that they like particularly want to eat her. Like, she's a little tiny, but they have nothing. So like,
yeah,
somebody makes that decision. My guess is they bury her with the rest of the people
because
they're not there yet.
Right.
But
I would hope they wouldn't jump into it that quickly.
Yeah.
I don't think they will. I don't think so.
Yeah. I don't know how they get there either. I mean, it's a real act of desperation for sure.
And who brings it up? You know, just even bringing it up.
Lottie
will probably bring it up and probably be the first one to actually take a bite, and others will likely follow suit.
For sure.
But yeah, the cannibalism part, that is going to be a whole nother trauma. We will have to revisit again with you once we get to season 2. Yeah, happy to.
There's no way that's not a huge thing. And again, I think like Lottie could say like animals eat animal. Like, I think they can justify, you can justify all these things.
Yes.
But like, when you get back to the real world where that justification is a crime, like your understanding of things is just not like, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, even like if you talk to people who are in wars, like when they come back, like they just don't feel like anything makes sense because like, it's just, everything is different. Nobody's going to understand. And so they just don't say anything. And I think that you get that experience a lot with them too, which is like, what do you tell people? Like, people are going to want to know, because there's a, just as much as we like watching the show, there's a voyeuristic tendency of people who've survived, like kidnappings, whatever. Like, everyone loves that stuff. Like, everyone wants to know all the details. That person doesn't want to tell you what happened when they were kidnapped, at all, right? And so we really like want to know, but the person's not ready, or they aren't going to ever tell us whatever, right? So I think there's also that, which is like, they're not going to feel like safe or like they belong for a long time, I'm sure, if ever. And yet other people are going to probably constantly want to know more and more and more. And so there's a level of what they gave people, because you can tell, you just don't know what that is. Like, is it like Jackie died and we had no food and Jackie died? They might even say Jackie died in the plane crash.
Right.
And so like, I would.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say like, I'm a teen, like I'm Shauna, I come back. Like, I'm not going to be like, oh yeah, like we got in a fight, she slept outside and I let her die. And you know, like, it's just
Jackie's
not,
parents wouldn't be talking to her if that had come out in the details.
No. And you can't explain. So. Like, I think it's, they big picture it. I'm sure. Like, we like found some animals and we found some water and we found, you know, like whatever they had to do to tell the story in a way that wasn't like, that felt safe and didn't feel revealing. But that probably ignored all of these like traumas we were just talking about, because I don't think anyone would understand them. Like, what's it like to see your coach impaled by a tree? Like, what's it like? Right. Nobody,
what's like, it you like can't to hunt down that. Your team members and have them fall into a tiger trap and get impaled? Yeah.
Like, you can't explain that to people. Like, people just like could never get it, like in a way that would feel like either they want to know for the wrong reasons or they're going to think you're a criminal and there's no in between. And I think that you wouldn't feel safe telling anybody any of it.
They're found in their second winter out there, right? Like, they're out there for 19 months. So they're found in like what, December of the second year that they're out there. I want to know if when they're found, if they're all wearing those crazy animal pelts and all that stuff, because what are the people that are finding them going to say, like, oh, you guys are just like, where'd you guys get these outfits? Oh,
cool, we costumes. Made them.
Yeah.
Old Navy.
Yeah.
they used Lottie's TJ Bucks.
Yeah.
I'm sure like there's some, like, I bet the people that find them don't tell everything either. Like,
yeah, that makes sense.
Because like, it's not their story. And I bet they see stuff they shouldn't see, like that they don't know what to make of. Like, yeah. I doubt that they like come across them when they're at a prom.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, they're not like, oh, we came and found them and they were dancing and they were happy. And like, clearly they survived so well. Like, I'm sure they were like traumatized by whatever they see and they don't want to talk about it either.
That's so true.
Like,
yeah,
absolutely.
As a person who's a healthcare worker and kind of holds a lot of that stuff, like, I don't see stuff, but like EMTs, first responders, like people like that really like are super traumatized by the things that they see, not the things that they're doing, you know? And so like, that would be the same, I think.
Yeah,
absolutely. Now moving into season two, what are some of the answers that you would like to find out the most? Like, maybe one or two things that you feel you need resolution for. Like, is it who's Pit Girl? What happened to Shauna's baby? I mean, there's a lot of different things we can speculate on. But what's like one or two things that you really, really want to get some answers to?
Well, first, I'd like to know what happened to Natalie at the end of the thing. Because like, she was like on to something. Like, I don't know what she was on to, but I think that's interesting. And we know from the show Twitter and stuff that some of the people are alive, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think I want to know kind of how that works. I think it was interesting they told us, which makes me think that they thought it was going to get leaked or something, because like, they didn't really have to tell us that some of those people were alive. Right. And then I guess I'm curious, like, I'm always going to be curious who they eat and when they get there.
Yes.
but I think just from a psychological perspective too, but I the baby thing is interesting to me. Because, like, does she have a baby? Where does it go? How does it live? Like, does she not have a baby? Which would make a lot more sense because she's malnourished and not having OBGYN care.
Yes.
Like, or did they all deliver her baby and take care of her? Like, that's also really traumatizing, right? Like, what, a bunch of teenage girls and a coach who's like, oh God, I got stuck with a bunch of teenage girls on a, with one leg for 18 months, right? Like, it's like probably his worst nightmare in so many ways. But I think the baby thing is like a very interesting like wrench that they threw into the conversation. But I think it makes people think a lot, because you could count and you'd be like, her daughter, nope.
Right.
Like, she's not there yet. Like, it doesn't make, it can't be her daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure. And do you have a favorite character just in general? Who's your favorite, teen, adult, both? Who do you love watching? It's really hard to pick because they're all just so incredible.
I'm a Nat fan. Yay! You know, and I think in a lot of ways, because, oh man, I just love the older, I love everything about her and all her other movies too. But I also think that I'm not like Nat. Like, I don't act like that. I sometimes wish I had that sort of like, I'm just going to buy a leather jacket and like enjoy my life.
Wear fishnets and shorts.
Yeah.
Like, not something I would
think
do
she's
either.
Like interesting. Like, she's just like a fun character in that way. And when she's younger, she's really badass. Like, she's still badass. But like, when she's younger, she's like, oh, I know how to use a gun. Like, look, I made all the things. And like, there's some like girl powerness to it that I like. And so I would probably say Nat.
All right. It's hard. I like Misty and Shauna, but I also appreciate Nat for all of those reasons. I mean, I appreciate all of them in different ways because they're all so phenomenal. But
it's really good character development for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, the writing, the casting, everything, as we always say, from top to bottom on the show is just absolutely brilliant. And I mean, we can't thank you enough for joining us today too, either. Do you have any more thoughts or insights you'd like to share that maybe we didn't touch upon, or Kelly or Emily, do you have any?
I mean, the only thing I think is like, people have asked me about the whole like Lottie and her meds situation. Yes. You know, I think there's a lot of mental health stuff to come. So like, whatever that looks like. But like, it seems like the showrunner is very aware of the dangers of making her be on meds to begin with. But that's like, if you're speaking of like pregnancy being a wrench, being off meds for question mark schizophrenia and trapped on a deserted, like whatever mountain, like there's a lot that can come from that. And it's very fine line between like what she's doing that's just her survival instinct and what she's doing that's mental illness. And so I think that that'll be interesting, because it's the most likely to go badly in my opinion, I have a very, very small window of like okayness with that kind of stuff. And so I think like, he's aware, which is a big plus. I really hope they have a lot of mental health consultants if they're going to make that a big storyline, because like that aspect of it has the potential to be like very frustrating to me. But I also am like very curious, like where they go with it. Because also like, people are misdiagnosed, which was kind of hinted at too. Right. Yeah. So like, how do you navigate that? And people are on antipsychotics for not schizophrenia. They've never said it was schizophrenia. So true. I also think that's interesting, but that is my bias to what I'm interested in. So I think that, but I do think in like a what happens in season two kind of way, like if they dive into that, it could be very interesting, it could be very tenuous, and I'm just curious to see kind of like where that goes.
Yes. And you know what? Speaking of that really quick, we had pulled this comment from Reddit user Skeeter Sammer, and she mentioned, or they mentioned, the almost car accidents. In episode 6, there were two sets of parents who were driving with their kids in the car. First, we see young Lottie with her parents. Out of nowhere, she starts screaming, and it prevents her family from getting into the car accident when the truck goes through the intersection. You know, the mom thinks that Lottie saved them, and meanwhile, the dad says they want to take her to a psychiatrist. And then halfway through the episode, Simone and Ty take Sammy to see a psychiatrist. And after the appointment, Sammy's in the back seat with his headphones on. Simone and Ty are talking, and Simone sees a biker, yells to Ty to watch out. And then they, again, avert an accident. And, you know, again, this may or may not mean anything. Maybe it's a stretch, but it is very strange that, you know, maybe Sammy's scene is some kind of a continuation. It's interesting that that all happens in the same episode with the mention of psychiatry and, you know, both with the younger children. Is there anything, any conclusion you could draw from that, or any parallels between maybe young Lottie and what Sammy's experiencing now?
Well, is the conclusion that, like, going to a psychiatrist and screaming after will save your life, or is it not to go to a psychiatrist? That's the question.
Right.
You know, there's probably, they both have that, like, sort of spiritual animal, like, think symbolism thing going on, which, you know, there's a lot of, like, religious symbolism in hallucinations and in people's experiences with schizophrenia. So that's possible. I mean, they would have no reason to be, like, related, right? Like, it like they're very different storylines in, yes, in even though it's the same storyline. But there's a lot of that in people who experience mental illness. And so it's, again, a pretty fine line of, like, is it mental illness? Is it a coping reaction? Is it actual religion and spirituality? And that happens a lot in, like, what I do and in people wanting diagnoses for people who are, like, cult leaders and, like, stuff like that. That's not usually mental illness. It's, like, narcissism plus some, yeah, ability to, like, you know, get people to believe you. But it could just be an interesting skill set that they both have of, like, again, protecting people or that they care about. I don't know. Right. But I don't know if they intended to make it all in the conversation around psychiatry, but we're happy to be that person. That's always that person, you know, like, so far they haven't made it seem like we're the devil, which is nice.
Yes.
Which could easily happen. And it's part of why I hate horror. So I don't like horror because I was a scaredy cat kid and I couldn't watch stuff like that. And I'd leave my friends' houses if they put on The Ring. But in the same sense, like, scary movies like to minimize mental illness, take place, yeah, during things that, or someone has mental illness, take place in a hospital. And so I have this, like, strong aversion, and they haven't changed, and I don't know that they're going to. So I have a strong aversion to watching that stuff because I'm like, you're not helping. Like, yeah, this is right, really bad. And so far, Yellow Jackets hasn't really done that, like, with the way they talk about psychiatry. But, like, they're bad psychiatrists. But I think that, like, a lot of times you get just that they're a bad psychiatrist, not that they're also good ones. And, like, or this person's bad because of X, Y, or Z, but I've heard of other people who have good ones. Like, whatever you want to do that balances that conversation doesn't tend to exist. So I'm hoping that the car crashes and stuff, like, aren't, like, foreshadowing something bad that psychiatry does, because,
right,
like, we got enough to deal with on our
plate. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, all of your insights into this are just absolutely incredible. And it's been something we've wanted to explore this whole time. And, you know, we're very excited to see how Yellow Jackets continues to explore some of these traumas, trauma responses, and how things unfold in season two. And, you know, if you'd be open to joining us again, you know, maybe towards the middle to end of season two, we could kind of reevaluate, you know, yeah, how some of the adults are coming along and explore more once we get a little bit more context, as you mentioned, into some of the families and, you know, their earlier experiences before the plane crash as well.
We'll have some new adults to speculate about too.
We will. Yeah. And we'll have a cult to talk about. And, you know, you mentioned cults, yes, earlier, and, you know, mm-hmm, we can save all of the cult diagnoses for our season two.
I wish I knew more about cults. Like, sometimes I'll watch that stuff, like, you know, documentaries on Netflix and stuff, and I'll be like, I really should read about this. And then I'll be like, but why do I want to keep reading about this? Like, I need to read, like, Reese Witherspoon's book club and call it a day. Like,
yes. I'm obsessed with all that stuff. If there's a same documentary on cults, I'm watching it.
Yes, same, absolutely. Well, any other questions, Kelly or Emily, or are we good to wrap up?
You know what? We didn't get to our planned icebreaker question.
Oh, that's right. About that. I know. What's totally that? Dove right in. Yes. Go for the icebreaker question. We'll call it a post icebreaker question, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. Let's do that really quick. Okay. So let's all go through and Dr. Gold, we can start with you if you'd like.
You can call me Jessie, by the way. Okay. I never really like said that because you don't say Dr. Gold a million times, but it's totally fine.
Okay. Jessie, if you want, we can start with you. Who out of the Yellow Jackets cast, out of all the characters, who would you like to take on vacation and where would you go?
Like, I think my answer is still going to be Nat, but it's not because, like, I feel like saying that, then people are like, you want to go get drunk and do a bunch of drugs. Like, I don't want to do any, like, I'm fine with the way my life is. I think it's kind of to just, like, be more spontaneous and be more fun in that aspect of a vacation, even if I had to then, like, kind of worry about her half the time because that's my personality. I think, like, where would I go? I mean, somewhere like Vegas would be really fun.
Oh yeah.
But it's also like, how do you make somebody's like clear problems more of a problem? And, but also like make it a little fun for you because they're a problem. Yeah. So I kind of feel bad that that's my answer, but that's like what comes to mind is like something like that would be fun. And then I would probably say, I just made her worse. I feel bad. Can I send her to treatment now?
Melanie, how about you?
You know, I was kind of wavering between going with like one of those music cruises with Nat and going somewhere with Shauna. And I think I choose Shauna. I feel like adult Shauna is ready to let loose. She's jumping off bridges. She's like going to raves. I think she'd be a lot of fun, but she also has her practical side, right? So I don't know where we'd go. I feel like maybe I love beach vacations. So probably like, you know, a beach somewhere. And then maybe we'd go do some like thrill activities or something like, I don't know, some jet skiing or I don't know, snorkeling or something fun. So Shauna, I think. I love Shauna.
Cool. Emily, what about you?
I would have to go with Nat too. And I think like I would want to go somewhere like a music festival like Coachella or Bamboozle or something like that, because I just feel like she would be such a great time at a concert and she would be such good company.
I'm going with Ty. And I want to take Ty to Ireland. That's where most of my, I have a lot of extended family in Ireland that I've never met. My grandparents are from there. So it's on my, it's probably the number one place on my bucket list to visit. And Thaisa just seems like she'd be a lot of fun to go out to the Irish pubs with and just go on vacation with in general. So
seems like be like the most traveled out of all of them too.
Yeah. She seems like she would be so much fun and just super laid back. And, you know, and it also kind of seems like she would be the least judgmental out of everybody too.
Yes. Well, let's gear up for some vacations ahead of season 2 of Yellow Jackets. And Jessie, you know, thank you again for joining us. We cannot thank you enough for this. And hopefully we can revisit things once season 2 comes. And I mean, your expertise and your experience just lends itself to so much credibility when analyzing these fictional characters, which again, as you said, gives you a little bit more leverage for.
Oh, yeah. They get mad when we do it with real people. I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that. And I actually believe pretty strongly in that. But I think it's nice when they're fictional characters because I can have the actual conversations that sometimes would be nice to have about some of the real people that are in the media. So yeah, I appreciate it. I'm down to have these conversations whenever I think it's fun.
Awesome. Well, again, we're just going to show Dr. Gold's article here. It is an In Style. It is titled, I'm a Psychiatrist and Yellow Jackets is one of the best portrayals of trauma I've seen on TV. You can find that at instyle.com. We're putting the link here along the bottom. And
all my editors will like that a lot. So I appreciate that. They're wonderful. So I like, you know, having a fashion magazine write about mental health at all is like, you know, a big
thing.
That's
pretty awesome.
So yeah,
I put a lot of props in the way that they've done things and given me freedom to write what I need to or what I think would be good. So
absolutely.
That's excellent. Props to them for that.
Yes. And again, pop culture tying into trauma, I think is great just because of that relatability, as we mentioned.
Yeah, for sure.
And we're also including all of Dr. Gold's website and social media handles in the show notes as well. So you can find those there. Make sure to check that out. She's got so many great articles to check out. So
very interesting. Yes. Thank you so much, Jessie. We're going to let you go. We're just going to wrap up really quick. But thank you again. And we hope to talk to you again soon.
All right.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
All right. Wow. Well, that was absolutely incredible. That's something we wanted to cover for a while. And, you know, I mean, Jessie, Dr. Gold was absolutely amazing with analyzing the trauma. Absolutely. All right. Well, I think we should shout out our honorary antler queen quick. Thank you to Phoenix L. We bow to you for your support. You are our very first honorary antler queen. If you would like to join our hive, you can visit patreon.com/theantlerqueens and get some exclusive perks, some fun stuff. Check us out. And on social media, we're the Antler Queens. Our website is theantlerqueens.com. And with that, hey, Kelly.
Hey, what, Melanie?
Buzz off. Hey, Emily.
Buzz off.
Yeah.
Buzz off.
Buzz off.
All right. And with that, buzz off. The Antler Queens are out.